Three different men, each with a raised fist, are pictured on the front of three papers: the Irish Examiner, Irish Independent, and Irish Times. The men are variously described as reacting or celebrating after a former Minneapolis police officer, Derek Chauvin, was found guilty yesterday on three charges relating to the death of George Floyd last May. Suzanne Lynch, reporting from Minneapolis for The Times, describes the trial as a landmark court case that shone a light on race relations and policing in America. Vaccine supply in Ireland is the main topic for two papers. The Irish Daily Mail says that Ireland's summer vaccine target hangs in the balance after the drug company AstraZeneca said it would only be able to deliver 9,000 doses between now and May, not the 45,000 due. The Times reports that government ministers have signalled they want as wide a reopening as possible in May, as the state's vaccination programme continues to suffer from supply shortfalls and restrictions on the use of vaccines. The Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, became the latest minister to suggest that the reopening of social and economic life in May and June is on track, the paper says. The Independent leads with a report by Shane Phelan that the health service executive is urgently reviewing the files of more than 1,500 child and adolescent patients who attended mental health services in South Kerry between 2016 and the end of last year. The paper says it is feared that a considerable number of these patients were prescribed medication dosages more appropriate to adults and may have suffered significant health problems as a result. The Examiner's lead story concerns what the paper calls a damning new report on the coroner's service by the Irish Council of Civil Liberties. The service has been accused of being biased, over-influenced by Gardaí, and of accepting deaths of mothers in labour as inevitable, Aoife Moore reports. The Irish Sun's top story is about the three men who appeared in court last night over the shooting of David Byrne at the Regency Hotel in Dublin in 2016. And the paper says cops have launched a Europe-wide manhunt for Gerry Hutch, known as the Monk, as reported in the Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Daily Star. A 14-year-old cellist, Emily Brazel from Donnybrook, Dublin, has her picture in the Times, Independent and Examiner. The papers note that the Fesh Ceoil virtual gala celebration takes place this weekend, featuring highlights from the classical music competitions held in March. The online event will be available to watch through feshceoil.ie from Friday until Sunday.
It took a Minneapolis jury just over 10 hours to find ex-police officer Derek Chauvin guilty of murdering George Floyd. The killing and video evidence of Chauvin kneeling on Mr. Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes shook the nation and sparked a movement. The New York Times called the verdict a rare rebuke of police conduct following decades of police officers going without charges or convictions after killing black men, women and children. Here's how the verdict was announced.
We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April 2021 at 1:44 p.m. Signed, juror foreperson, juror number 19. Same caption, verdict count two. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count two, third-degree murder perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April 2021 at 1:45 p.m. Signed by jury foreperson, juror number 19. Same caption, verdict count three. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count three, second-degree manslaughter, culpable negligence, creating an unreasonable risk, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April 2021 at 1:45 p.m. Jury foreperson, 019.
Our correspondent, Brian O'Donovan, is in Minneapolis, and he's been describing the scene as the jury brought back those guilty verdicts.
Hennepin County Courthouse is in downtown Minneapolis. Normally would be a busy, bustling part of the city, but not yesterday. It was very, very quiet. A massive security presence, armed National Guard troops, military trucks, fencing. There were no protesters, no members of the public, but there was a very tense atmosphere, a sense of anticipation that something was coming. Now, it was announced around an hour in advance that this verdict would be coming, and word spread quickly. So in a very short space of time, we saw a large crowd starting to gather outside the courthouse. They watched on their phones as Judge Peter Cahill read the jury's verdicts aloud. Guilty on all three counts. Second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and manslaughter. This huge cheer went up from the crowd. People wept. They hugged each other. Passing cars started beeping their horns. Inside the courtroom, Derek Chauvin didn't react in any obvious way as the verdicts were read out. He was handcuffed, taken into custody, and he will be sentenced in 8 weeks' time. Now, outside on the street, many of the people I spoke to said they were very relieved. Many of them said they did not expect guilty verdicts because it is unusual and quite difficult to secure a conviction of a police officer in these types of cases. The people I met said that while they were celebrating this win, there were still lots of other African Americans who had suffered at the hands of police, and that there is a long road ahead.
What is your reaction to this evening's verdict?
It's ecstatic. It's surreal, really. But this is just the first stepping stone into getting justice for black people and police brutality.
I am overjoyed. I feel like finally America for 400 years has been in desperate need of a heart transplant. I feel like the judge and the jury finally diagnosed it. Now it's time for us to get to groundwork and do the actual work it takes to build this community up here in America to make sure that African Americans and people of color and the marginalized and the voiceless actually have a voice in this country. Today's a step in the right direction.
A step in the right direction, but still a lot more work to do, you would say?
Absolutely. This only cranked the car up for the very long journey that we've got to take as a country.
And Brian, how did George Floyd's family react to those three guilty verdicts?
Well, immediately after the verdict, Mary, George Floyd's brother Philonis said he was praying for a guilty verdict and that he was worried because he said, as an African American, we usually don't get justice. He told a press conference that the family felt they could finally breathe again. Remember, of course, George Floyd's dying words were, "I can't breathe," as Derek Chauvin knelt on his neck for more than 9 minutes. It was captured on a video that went viral and sparked a global protest movement. Now, the defense tried to implant doubt in the jury's minds by suggesting that drug use or an underlying health condition might have been the cause of death, but the prosecution had that shocking piece of video footage as their strongest piece of evidence, and they told the jurors, believe your eyes, trust your instincts, remember the feelings you first felt when you saw that video, and use your common sense. Now, the US President Joe Biden called George Floyd's family immediately after the verdict came in, and he said, now at least there is some sense of justice. Earlier, and rather controversially, Joe Biden had taken a very unusual step of expressing his views on the trial before the jury had come back. And he said he was praying for the right verdict. He and the Vice President Kamala Harris delivered a joint address to the nation last night. They both spoke about the problem of systemic racism here in the US, and they both called on Congress to pass police reform legislation.
Today, we feel a sigh of relief. Still, it cannot take away the pain. A measure of justice isn't the same as equal justice. This verdict brings us a step closer, and the fact is, we still have work to do. We still must reform the system. America has a long history of systemic racism.
It was a murder in the full light of day, and it ripped the blinders off for the whole world to see the systemic racism the Vice President just referred to. The systemic racism is a stain on our nation's soul. The knee on the neck of justice for Black Americans. Profound fear and trauma. The pain, the exhaustion that Black and Brown Americans experience every single day.
President Biden reacting there. And of course, Brian, this isn't the end of this investigation or the criminal proceedings. There are other police officers to face trial.
That's right, Mary. There are three other now former police officers who were involved in George Floyd's arrest that day and were in one way or another involved in that restraining. They've been charged with aiding and abetting second-degree murder and aiding and abetting second-degree manslaughter. They've all pleaded not guilty. Their trial will be held in the summer. It may, of course, also not be the end of the road for Derek Chauvin when it comes to his case. He is expected to appeal and he will no doubt make reference to this massive publicity surrounding the case and will no doubt claim that this could have tainted the jury. Earlier this week, the trial judge criticised the fact that politicians had been making public statements on this case and said that that could well be grounds for an appeal in the future. For now, however, those who felt so upset and so hurt and so angry when they saw George Floyd take his last breaths will themselves be breathing a sigh of relief.
Our correspondent Brian O'Donovan reporting from Minneapolis.
A plan by some of the biggest football clubs in England, Italy and Spain to form a league of their own, announced on Sunday to surprise and huge opposition, is in tatters this morning after at least six clubs withdrew their support last night, with some apologising to their fans. The European Super League would have seen 15 founding clubs receive a £200 to £300 million golden hello to play in a midweek competition from which they could never be relegated. Jonathan Wilson is author and football writer for The Guardian. He's with us now. Jonathan, you're very welcome to Morning Ireland.
Thanks, how are you doing?
So for the second time in a few days, Chelsea have beaten Manchester City, this time to be first out the door of the Super League. What just happened and why?
I think the pressures leading to this had been building for a while. I think we've seen greater and greater disparities between the big clubs and the smaller clubs. And I think a few of us have been predicting for a while that the Super League was the logical consequence if one we didn't want to see happen. I think what's really precipitated it is partly the pandemic and the economic pressure that's placed on clubs, but also a sense, and this is where it gets complicated, from the traditional elites, so the likes of Real Madrid and Manchester United, a sense that the petro clubs, if we can call them that, so Chelsea, Manchester City, Paris Saint-Germain, the clubs who are owned by either an oligarch or the sovereign wealth fund of a state, and a sort of, they exist outside the market, they're not dependent on the market to generate their revenues. The traditional elite have been terrified of them for several years. They hope that the financial fair play legislation that had been introduced would keep them in check. I think there's been a feeling since last year when Manchester City were initially banned by UEFA for breach of FFP regulations, and then that suspension was overturned. I think that brought a sense among the traditional elites that these clubs couldn't be reined in, and so they needed another guaranteed source of revenue. So they put in place the Super League proposals. They then end up having to invite these clubs anyway. Paris Saint-Germain declined the invitation, and I think very sensibly saw the way the wind was blowing. Chelsea, Manchester City go along with it, although they were very clearly the fifth and sixth of the Premier League clubs to sign up, and then they're the first two to pull out. So that's roughly what's happened.
Is it clear, Jonathan, where the money was coming from and who was going to broadcast these games if it ever happened?
It's not clear at all, and that's one of the extraordinary things about this. I mean, we know that JP Morgan had agreed some kind of funding of, well, 3.5 billion euros. As to the terms of that, we don't know that yet. As to who would broadcast it, I think that's a huge issue. So Joel Glazer from Manchester United, he came out on Sunday and he said that they estimated revenues for this tournament to be 5 billion euros per year. Now, if you look at UEFA's figures for the last Champions League round before the pandemic hit, which obviously has hit revenues, that was 3.3 billion. So you're talking about a 50% increase. Now, of that 3.3 billion, 2.4 billion came from TV rights. But Florentino Perez, the president of Real Madrid, who was president of a new league, he said on Monday that one of the reasons they had to take this step was that broadcast revenues had levelled off and perhaps were going to decline. So where do they get from that 3.3 to 5 if it's not coming from increased broadcast revenues? Now, maybe it would be some kind of streaming platform. But what I thought was really interesting yesterday was when Amazon came out and said, we don't want no part of this. This is not part of our business model. So you then start thinking, well, who on earth is going to do this? So I think the whole thing has a sense of being rushed out without much concrete planning.
Does this leave the way clear now for a revised Champions League, not next season, but the season after, with two places reserved for, I think they're being phrased, pedigree clubs?
Yeah, I mean, on Monday, UEFA voted through the proposed changes for Champions League to begin in 2024. Now, what I think is intriguing about that is that there was a clause in that that said that this is subject to change if the circumstances change. Now, it may be that UEFA think we're giving away too much here. They've been appeasing the big clubs for 20 years. And Alexander Čeferin, the president of UEFA, he was furious in a way you never see something like that furious on Monday. You know, he was calling these clubs snakes and liars. He really attacked Andrea Agnelli, to whose daughter he happens to be godfather, which, you know, complicates everything even more. He was talking about human values being lost. So I think his instinct for appeasement is over, and I think we may see more battles ahead. But yes, as you say, as the proposal stand that we voted for on Monday, it'll be an expanded group stage with more games and these two legacy places, these for clubs who have done well in Europe in the past, who have a high coefficient but wouldn't otherwise have qualified.
Briefly, Jonathan, I suspect you could give a very long answer to this one if you wanted to. Why do you think the most vocal opposition came from England?
I think English fans are very well organised. I think English fans have a sense of community and of mutual solidarity, which is not there in other countries. I think the fact that the English pyramid has 92 teams in it in the league, plus all the leagues below that, and their support to a level that you don't see anywhere else in the world. In Spain, once you get below the big three, crowd figures dip off rapidly. So I think England has, because the game began here, because the idea of a league began here. I think that sense of football as being something for everybody, okay, that super clubs are somehow distasteful. I think that exists here. So, yeah, a combination of that and the very good organisation of English fans.
Jonathan Wilson, pleasure to have you on. Thanks for speaking to us.
The European Medicines Agency has said the benefits of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine outweigh the risks. The use of the one-dose vaccine was halted by US regulators last week after a small number of blood clots were reported and the manufacturer had delayed rollout across Europe. The EMA said its safety committee concluded that a warning about unusual blood clots with low blood platelets should be added to the vaccine's labels. Here, NIAC will be examining the findings before making a recommendation to the Deputy Chief Medical Officer. I'm joined by Dr. Dennis O'Keefe. He's a consultant haematologist at University Hospital Limerick. Dr. O'Keefe, good morning.
Good morning.
So what do we know so far? What's the data telling us about any possible links between the Johnson & Johnson vaccine now and these rare clotting events, and indeed why these events might occur?
Well, I guess firstly, the data from the United States sets out that there have been 8 cases in 7.5 million people who've been given the vaccine, which makes it, the conclusion is about 1 in a million people can be affected by this. And based on that, the risk is less than the risk associated with AstraZeneca. But interestingly, the actual causation and the syndrome of clotting that's been caused by this seems to be almost exactly the same that's associated by AstraZeneca. So it does look like it's probably the same mechanism that's triggering it.
And is it also the same in that it's presenting in mostly women under the age of 60?
Correct. It looks like it's exactly the same. I mean, obviously the number of cases thus far has been much smaller because it's been given to a much smaller number of people, relatively speaking, and the number of cases is smaller. But you're absolutely correct. The group that's been primarily affected is mostly women under the age of 60.
We're told that this particular type of clotting event is extremely rare. In what circumstances would you see clotting of this nature in the course of your work?
Yeah, so it is extremely rare. We typically see that the two types which are extremely rare are those which affect the brain, what we call a cerebral sinus thrombosis. And this we see very rarely associated with pregnancy and the combined oral contraceptive pill. In the Midwest here in Limerick, we would see about 1 to 2 cases per year. And the other type, which is what we call splanchnic, which affects the veins within the around the stomach and abdomen, again, we would see about 3 to 4 cases per year associated with very rare other clotting disorders.
And again, generally presenting in women in younger age groups?
No, No, this is very different, and the mechanism is clearly very different. So the mechanism we think is much more typical of a syndrome that we typically see with heparin. And of course, heparin has been used for many years for blood thinning treatment. So it's primarily associated with heparin, and again, extremely rare, that it triggers an immune response that causes clotting. So the mechanism is very, very different and much more typical of that condition called HIDS.
And is it always treatable? Talk us, I think it's worthwhile going through the symptoms that present again.
Yes, I mean, certainly it looks like as cases have, as a number of cases have happened and the knowledge has spread amongst our community who treat clots, it's become clear that in the majority of people it is treatable, and that treatment combines the treatment we treat with what's called antibodies or immunoglobulin, which is taken from blood donors, in combination with blood thinning treatment, and currently at the moment we avoid heparin because of the possibility of the two interacting. So it is a very, it is a treatable condition. And if you look at the American cases, of the 8 cases, 1 person died. And so 7 people were successfully treated. So it is important to state that.
The question now, of course, is does this country proceed with the use of the Johnson & Johnson one-dose vaccine? And there's a lot of pluses for a one-dose delivery. Or do we confine it to the age group that we have already categorized the AstraZeneca for? What's your own view?
Yeah, I mean, obviously these are very difficult questions, and NIAC have to weigh up the very, very small risk versus the very significant risk of COVID and, of course, the access to other vaccines. So I think still on balance that based upon the vaccines available to us that, you know, that it's likely they're going to recommend its use, possibly with an age limit, that it should be given above a certain age. But, of course, it very much depends. COVID is still in the community. It's still causing the death, unfortunately, of people. And if we don't have, you know, significant access to the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, then it still makes a great deal of sense to use the Johnson & Johnson for, as you say, the reason that it's a one-shot dose.
That's the calculation, though, isn't it, that has to be made? And I know that medical professionals and scientists have used that expression time and time again, proceeding with an abundance of caution.
Yeah, it is. And of course, they're very difficult decisions. And of course, they have to change as the scientific evidence comes out. But I think NIAC have done as good a possible job as they can do with the evidence available, weighing up once again, how much vaccine do you have in terms of the choices? How common is COVID currently in the community? And how extremely rare these complications are? And I think that based on that, it's likely they will recommend the use of this vaccine over the coming weeks. But they'll do it with the best and most cautious advice.
Dr. Dennis O'Keefe, thank you for your time this morning.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid. Kia. Movement that inspires.
No balls and bowls this morning, just lots of sports news. And Pádraic Lodge. Morning, Pádraic.
Good morning, Gavin. Yes, the bowls are put away now till the hurling qualifier draws later on in the year, but the focus very much this morning on that breakaway European Super League project, which appears to be in tatters after the 6 English Premier League clubs involved quit 48 hours after agreeing to join Italian and Spanish teams in the new elite competition. Manchester City were the first to back out of the venture, and then one by one, Arsenal, Manchester United, Tottenham, Liverpool and Chelsea announced they were following suit. The Super League issued a statement which suggested they may be suspending their project but stopped short of abandoning it altogether. They said, given the current circumstances, we will reconsider the most appropriate steps to reshape the project. On Sky Television last night, pundit Graham Souness said the divisions caused by the plan will not be easily mended.
The supporters will not forgive the people who decided to go for this idea. They will not forgive them because they're thinking, you know, they come on, they talk a good game, they tell us how much they love their football clubs, how much they're behind it, and they're here for the long term, and they've been shown to be people that would take the quick money, you know, that they would sell their soul, basically. They were going to sell the souls of our major football institutions. They go beyond football clubs. They mean so much to so many people. They were selling institutions for a quick, you know, a few bob, quick money. And our supporters will not forgive them. We're not America. And I don't know how these clubs will manage to get back on side. I think that's just the tip of the iceberg. I think you see a lot more people that have to resign from the positions.
That's Graham Souness. Danny Mandrow scored a 95th minute goal for Shamrock Rovers to give them a 1-0 win away to Drogheda United last night. The victory ensures the Hoops remain top of the League of Ireland Premier Division. Also with the same number of points are Sligo Rovers, who beat Bohemians 3-1 at Dalymount Park, and St Patrick's Athletic, who defeated Waterford 1-0 at Richmond Park, thanks to a goal from Leaving Cert student Dara Burns. Longford Town versus Finn Harps finished 0-0, and there was a 1-1 draw at the Brandywell between Derry City and Dundalk. Derry remained bottom of the table. In England, Chelsea shared a goalless draw with Brighton at Stamford Bridge to climb into the Champions League places in the Premier League. Belfast Mark Allen cruised into the second round of the World Snooker Championship with a 10-2 win over China's Liu Haiyichan. Having led 7-2 going into the evening session, Allen won three more frames in a row to ease to victory and set up a clash with either Mark Selby or Curt Mafflin. Ulster champions Cavan will begin their defence of their provincial title with a quarter-final away to Tyrone. The other quarter-finals are Monaghan against Fermanagh, Armagh versus Antrim, and Derry taking on the winner of the preliminary round game between Down and Donegal. The championship will begin at the end of June. Dan Martin finished third on the second stage of the Tour of the Alps. Simon Yates took the stage win to seize the overall race lead. Martin is now third in general classification, 1 minute and 4 seconds behind Yates. There was disappointment at the national team trials in Abbottstown for both Brendan Hyland in the 200 metres butterfly and Jack McMillan in the 200 metres freestyle. Both won their semi-finals but were marginally outside the Olympic qualifying standard. They'll now hope to go quicker in the final tonight. In rugby, the RFU has given its backing to England head coach Eddie Jones following the team's fifth place finish in the Six Nations Championship. A series of recommendations were made to improve performance, including the introduction of enhanced sports psychology for players and coaches. Confirmation from trainer Paul Nicholls that after discussions with the owners of Clan des Obo, he's decided to supplement the dual King George winner for the Punchestown Gold Cup next Wednesday. And in golf, Seamus Power has been forced to withdraw from this weekend's New Orleans Classic after contracting COVID-19.
The US president will host a climate summit with 40 world leaders from tomorrow. The meeting will be virtual and comes against a backdrop of a huge rebound in carbon gas emissions this year after lockdowns around the world last year, and a promise from the US to cut its emissions to try help slow down a rise in the world's temperature. A report by the International Energy Agency say most of the emissions surge this year is because of more coal burning in Asia. Dr. Dermot Tourney is Associate Professor in the School of Law and Government in DCU. Dr. Tourney, good morning. Thanks for talking to us today. We'll talk about the summit shortly, but first, that report by the International Energy Agency, it painted a very gloomy picture and begged the question, what, if anything, will change on climate policy if or when this pandemic is over?
Good morning, Gavin. Thanks for having me on. Yes, the IEA report yesterday did, as you say, paint a gloomy picture. What it really tells us is that a global pandemic is not a sustainable way to reduce our impact on the climate. We saw last year a large decline in the order of 5% emissions reduction last year, but basically a rebound to where we were in 2019, more or less. And that tells us that in recovery, we're not yet learning we're not yet reflecting on our unsustainable practices. The pandemic is an opportunity to think again about how we live our lives, and I think yesterday's report from the IEA tells us that as things stand, we are to a significant extent returning to the status quo, which is disappointing to see.
Okay.
On the question of China, though, it's interesting to note also that China, the growth in renewables this year is also driven by China. So China is of a scale that everything China does on the negative and the positive side looks very big in a global context.
It's China and Russia are taking part in the summit when it wasn't clear initially that they would. Why is Joe Biden hosting this summit now?
So I think there are a couple of reasons. One is to signal to the world that the US is back on the global stage, committed to multilateralism and committed to climate change, two things which obviously his predecessor strongly rejected. It's also a chance for Biden to showcase his climate plans domestically, and it's expected that Biden will announce a significant decarbonization commitment. It's being reported, or it's widely expected, that the U.S. commitment will be in the order of a 50% reduction compared to 2005 levels by 2030. So there's a domestic element and a global element to the summit. Of course, it also coincides with Earth Day, which takes place tomorrow.
Yes. Briefly, Dr. Tommy, Ireland is involved. How are they involved and why?
Well, Ireland, although a small part of the global picture, Ireland's greenhouse gas emissions are high on a per capita basis. So our individual greenhouse gas emissions are high by global standards. One of the significant things on the domestic climate agenda today is that the revised climate bill is being introduced in the Dáil, and that's expected to pass through the legislative process over the coming weeks and months, and that'll commit Ireland to stronger climate action, and will put in place a set of binding carbon budgets, overall caps over a 5-year period on greenhouse gas emissions.
Dr. Diabatoni, apologies, we need to leave it there, but thank you very much for speaking to us. Dr. Tony's Associate Professor in the School of Law and Government in DCU.
RTE News has learned that two healthcare workers were forced to leave their nursing home jobs, which they'd held throughout the pandemic, because they were told they could no longer avail of a HSE temporary accommodation scheme. The HSE, though, has confirmed to RTE News that the accommodation scheme is still operating. The workers were moved to direct provision centres between 90 and 200 kilometres from their place of work. The matter will be raised in the Dáil later this week. Our reporter Laura Fletcher spoke to the two workers.
So I have to take two buses, a tram, going there, coming back, two buses, a tram. It takes roughly about 2.5 hours.
A 90-kilometre commute has led this healthcare worker to leave her job at the nursing home where she worked throughout the pandemic.
It's really depressing, Laura, honestly.
Before the COVID-19 crisis, this healthcare worker lived in a direct provision centre much closer to her work. She later moved into temporary accommodation provided by the HSE, which was also within a commuting distance.
When the pandemic started, we were told that we couldn't come to work because we are coming from direct provision centres. So, you know, when you are coming from direct provision centres, you are a high risk of contaminating other residents, as well as contaminating the residents in the nursing home. So that's why when we were moved to the HSE accommodation.
But she says she was recently told she could no longer avail of the scheme.
My employer told me that you can't stay in the HSE accommodation anymore, because they said we don't have any case in our nursing home.
Vaccinations of staff and residents have led to a welcome drop in COVID-19 infections in nursing homes, but the HSE says the temporary accommodation scheme for healthcare workers has not been discontinued, and the eligibility criteria, as laid out in a national guidance document, still apply. Nowhere in that document does it say that eligibility depends on there being COVID-19 infections in a workplace. Yet we spoke to another healthcare worker who told us a similar story.
So they told me they could not renew my accommodation. So I talked to my manager. My manager tried to write to the HSE. They were like, no, we cannot extend it because you don't have an outbreak at the nursing home.
In addition to these personal testimonies, RTE News has seen emails from the HSE and from nursing home managers discussing COVID cases within nursing homes when dealing with applications to accommodate healthcare workers under the scheme. Irish Solidarity People Before Profit TD Breathe Smith is going to raise the matter in the Dáil.
The workers can't access the scheme, and yet the HSE are saying it's there. So many care workers are being forced back into direct provision, often very, very far from where they work. So we need clarity, and there's two ministers who are directly responsible. On the health side, obviously Stephen Donnelly, and on the direct provision side, Minister Roderick O'Gorman. And between them, they need to get rid of this roadblock and give us clarity and make sure that those workers are safe and are able to work.
The HSE told RTE News that it is not aware of any person who has made an application and who meets the eligibility criteria being refused a place in the temporary accommodation scheme, and it is possible to appeal decisions. The Irish Refugee Council's employment officer, Greta Keegan, has represented healthcare workers who've encountered difficulties accessing the scheme.
So over the last few months, I've worked with over 36 who've had ongoing issues, and that could be around mediation with their employers or the community health organisation to clarify that they do have a need, an ongoing need.
The Department of Children, Equality, Disability, Integration and Youth is now in charge of direct provision. When asked about placing returning healthcare workers so far from their place of work, it issued a statement saying it was not possible in every case for a person to return to their previous accommodation and that each request is examined on an individual basis.
I miss my patients because I have to ring my friends every time. How is this one doing? Yeah, and my friends as well.
The two healthcare workers we spoke to are now living in direct provision centres between 90 and 200 kilometres from their old workplaces. One has begun work at another nursing home, the other is looking for another job. Though vaccinated, they still worry about the risks of sharing accommodation with people who are not. But most of all, they say they simply miss the colleagues and patients in the workplaces they've left behind.
You feel like you don't want to leave them. You still want to help them. You get used to everyone, like the workers, your managers, then the people you're looking after. It was so painful, to tell you the truth, but I had no choice.
Laura Fletcher reporting there.
It's two items on business this morning. We'll begin with the makers of Kerrygold, Ornua, reporting a 69% increase in operating profit for last year to €83.1 million. The dairy company exports to 110 countries and sold 10 million packets of Kerrygold every week last year, an increase of 13%. John Jordan is CEO of Ornua. John, do you think last year was such a good year for Ornua because people were eating at home and baking at home while they were still stuck at home?
Good morning, Petula. Yeah, and thank you for reporting on those results. Absolutely. I mean, COVID changed our world in so many ways, and, you know, a dramatic shift in consumer buying behavior. And if you think of, you know, somewhere like the US, which is one of our big markets, pre-COVID, food consumption was 50% in home, 50% out of home. But COVID changed all that because of lockdowns, and we saw a huge surge in retail demand, a collapse in food service. And with our teams, we were very focused on our customers and consumers. And exactly as you say, Petula, we saw a lot more at-home eating, a lot more baking. People moved to brands they can trust. And thankfully, Kerrygold was in many of those sandwiches, many of those meals and many of those recipes. And as you say, 10 million packs per week of sales around the world, which is a phenomenal result.
A strong performance for Ornua is good news for your member cooperatives and the farmers who supply them.
Indeed, and Ornua, as you rightly say, is a cooperative. We were owned by the manufacturing co-ops in Ireland, who were in turn owned by 14,000 Irish dairy farming families. And we're adamant that they produce some of the best quality milk in the world. In 2020, Ornua purchased over €1 billion worth of Irish dairy products. And we made that commitment very early in the COVID pandemic to give some security and assurance to people. We believe we paid very strong prices. We've declared a very strong value payment, and very importantly, Petula, we kept markets and supply chains open throughout the world, which was to the benefit of the entire Irish dairy industry.
Thanks, John. John Jordan, CEO of Ornua. The annual results of the local enterprise offices for 2020 show that 5,600 new jobs were created, but there was a net loss of around 1,500 in what was a challenging year for small businesses. Local enterprise offices approved over 13,000 vouchers to assist businesses get online or improve their online offering. This was up 950%. Padraig McElwee is chair of the Network of Local Enterprise Offices. Padraig, was moving businesses online the key to their survival?
Yeah, but Chula, it played a key role. It's probably one of the most positive aspects that came out of COVID because a lot of businesses hadn't an online presence prior to COVID. And the initial aim was really to help or assist local people buy from local businesses. But we got an added benefit in that many of businesses realized there was actually a wider market opportunity in export markets. And for a lot of people, the global market has now become their local market. So it's a good news story coming out of a very tough year.
And Padraig, what will your network of offices be doing to help businesses get back on their feet as the economy reopens?
Well, first and foremost, our key role will be to assist businesses to get back on their feet. And with the support of the Department of Enterprise, Enterprise Ireland and the local authorities, we're actually well positioned to build on the supports we delivered in 2020. If you take, for example, the online, we've now got them online, but we need to develop their skill set that they can sell effectively online and, more importantly, get back to profit making. But we also have a wide range of supports with our typical funding supports through grants. We do a significant amount of online training. And probably one of the key supports we put in last year was actually one-to-one mentoring support just to give businesses that assistance. Our goal this year will be recovery, improve competitiveness, and really develop innovation among our many enterprises.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Patrick McElwee, Chair of the Network of Local Enterprise Offices. Thank you.
A man with a raised fist is pictured on the front of three papers, the Irish Examiner, Irish Independent and Irish Times. But it's a different man in each case. They are variously described as reacting or celebrating after a former Minneapolis police officer, Derek Chauvin, was convicted yesterday of the murder of George Floyd last May. Suzanne Lynch, reporting from Minneapolis for The Times, describes the trial as a landmark court case that shone a light on race relations and policing in America. The Independent quotes the Floyd family's attorney, Ben Crump, as saying, "This is a victory for those who champion humanity over inhumanity." Vaccine supply in Ireland is the main topic for two papers. The Irish Daily Mail says that Ireland's summer vaccine target hangs in the balance after the drug company AstraZeneca said it would only be able to deliver 9,000 doses between now and May, not the 45,000 due. The Times reports that government ministers have signalled they want as wide a reopening as possible in May, as the state's vaccination programme continues to suffer from supply shortfalls and restrictions on the use of vaccines. The Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, became the latest minister to suggest that the reopening of social and economic life in May and June is on track, the paper says. The Independent leads with a report by Shane Phelan that the Health Service Executive is urgently reviewing the files of more than 1,500 child and adolescent patients who attended mental health services in South Kerry between 2016 and the end of last year. The paper says it is feared that a considerable number of these patients were prescribed medication dosages more appropriate to adults and may have suffered significant health problems as a result. The Examiner's lead story concerns what the paper calls a damning new report on the Coroner's Service by the Irish Council of Civil Liberties. The service has been accused of being biased, over-influenced by Gardaí, and of accepting deaths of mothers in labour as inevitable, Aoife Moore reports. The Irish Sun's top story is about the three men who appeared in court last night over the shooting of David Byrne at the Regency Hotel in Dublin in 2016. The Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Daily Star also cover that story. A 14-year-old cellist, Emily Brazel from Donnybrook, Dublin, has her picture in The Times, Independent and Examiner. The papers note that the Fesh Ceoil virtual gala celebration takes place this weekend, featuring highlights from the classical music competitions held in March. The online event will be available to watch through feshceoil.ie from Friday until Sunday. The appointment of Robert Watt as Secretary General of the Department of Health prompts an editorial in The Examiner. The writer says it will possibly strengthen the view that a tight, all but impenetrable golden circle runs this country. That impression is hardly softened by the concession that Mr. Watt will temporarily waive an €81,000 pay hike. But still on health matters, there's a note of gratitude in a letter to The Times. B. Connors of Portmarnock, County Dublin, says, "I have just now received my first COVID vaccination. To the scientists who produced it, and so quickly, I salute you and I thank you."
A white former police officer has been found guilty by a jury of the murder of an African-American man in the United States last year, A video of Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes during his arrest in Minneapolis last May sparked worldwide protests. The 45-year-old was found guilty on three charges: second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and manslaughter. Speaking last night, civil rights campaigner Reverend Al Sharpton said the guilty verdict for Derek Chauvin gives civil rights activists an assurance that their actions can yield results.
This is the first time in a long array of fights that we've seen three counts guilty at all three. We don't find pleasure in this. We don't celebrate a man going to jail. We would have rather George be alive.
Amen.
But we celebrate that we, because young people, white and black, some castigated, many that are here tonight, marched and kept marching and kept going. Many of them looked down on, but they kept marching and wouldn't let this die. And this is an assurance to them that if we don't give up, that we can win some rounds. But the war and the fight is not over. Just 2 days from now, we're going to have to deal with the funeral of Dante Wright in this same county, the same area. We still have cases to fight, but this gives us the energy to fight on.
That's campaigner Al Sharpton. George Floyd's brother, Philonise, gave an emotional reaction following the verdict.
I feel relieved today that I finally have the opportunity to, for hopefully getting some sleep. A lot of days that I prayed and I hoped and I was speaking everything into existence, I said I have faith that he will be convicted. Today, you have the cameras all around the world to see and show what happened to my brother. It was a motion picture, the world seeing his life being extinguished. And I could do nothing but watch.
George Floyd's brother, Philonise. President Joe Biden phoned George Floyd's family shortly after the verdict to express his support.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Gianna, well, doing?
I'm feeling better now. Nothing is going to make it all better, but at least God, now there's some justice.
Right.
And, you know, I think if Gianna's coming, my dad is going to change the world. He's going to start to change it now.
That's right.
Yes.
That's the President of the United States speaking to George Floyd's family by phone last night. Let's cross live now to the US and speak to Jamila Jefferson-Jones. She's Professor of Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Professor Jefferson-Jones, you're very welcome to Morning Ireland. Thank you for taking our call today.
Thank you for having me, Gavin.
Can I ask you for your reaction to this verdict and your view of the significance of the verdict?
So I'll tell you, I am very hopeful of what this portends, but there's also some caution there. We still have to get through sentencing. But this is a very big day, or has been a very big day yesterday, in that this is the first time that we've seen something like that this happen, where we have what should have been an open and shut case, thanks to Darnella Frazier's video, and we finally have this feeling that the rest of us can take a breath, to take that breath that George Floyd can no longer take, and say the system is working. That when someone uses excessive force, when a police officer uses excessive force, that there will be some sort of consequence. So that's really what's important here. And of course, you add in the racial elements that this was a white police officer and a black man that was killed. And it's just really important to show that the system can work and to give people the comfort that in the future it may work for us.
It's hard to overstate the importance of the video evidence here.
Yes, absolutely. The video evidence is what's able to show the rest of the world what Black America already knew and had already been facing. And it's, of course, helpful that this happened during the pandemic when everyone was home and watching around the world, right, watching TV. But I can't say how important it is that young Darnella Frazier had the courage to challenge the lie that was actually being told by the police department that George Floyd just had a medical incident. No, he was murdered on the street, and that was proven, and her video evidence was so, so important.
I'm reading reports that within minutes of this verdict that there was a fatal shooting of a teenage girl in Ohio by police, a black teenage girl. What, if anything, do you think will change in the U.S. after this?
What has to happen is that we have to deal with use of force issues, and the police have to be really reconfigured so that they are thinking, I must de-escalate. That's not where the police are now. Instead, what we have is this this idea that one must comply with the police at all times, and that if you do not do so, that the punishment is death. But these are not death penalty eligible crimes. We have George Floyd accused of a $20 forgery. That's not death eligible. We have this young woman, this young child, really, she's 16 years old, Makia Bryant, who actually called the police to help her. She was being, the idea is that she was being bullied by some other girls, and she called the police because there was fighting happening, and instead she ends up dead. And this is not how these things should turn out. Instead, the police should be there to de-escalate rather than to jump directly to deadly force.
Professor Jefferson Jones, if I can ask you finally, do you think today's verdict will make any difference to the mindset of a black person if they're being stopped by the police? Will they be any less fearful as a result of what's happened today?
Unfortunately, Gavin, I don't think so. I think that this is a moment in time, but that this is not about one bad apple having been removed from the street. This is, we need systemic change, and until that systemic change is enacted, I think that black people will still have fear.
Jamila Jefferson Jones, Professor of Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Thank you very much for taking our call today.
Three Dublin men have appeared before a late-night sitting of the Special Criminal Court last night, charged with helping a crime gang murder David Byrne at the Regency Hotel. He was shot dead at a boxing weigh-in by a gang of armed men dressed as Gardaí in February 2016. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds was in court. Paul, what can you tell us about the three men and what they've been charged with?
Mary, the three men are 64-year-old Patrick Dowdall from the Navan Road in Cabra in Dublin, 59-year-old Paul Murphy of Cherry Avenue, Swords in County Dublin, and 50-year-old Jason Bonney of Drimna Wood in Portmarnock in Dublin. They were all arrested yesterday. They were brought before three judges at a special late-night sitting of the Special Criminal Court last night. All three are charged with participating in or contributing to activity which could facilitate the commission of a serious offence by a criminal organisation or any of its members, namely the murder of David Byrne.
At this stage, have they all been remanded in custody, and do they intend applying for bail?
Well, we heard from three Detective Gardaí from Ballymun last night in relation to their arrests and what specifically they're alleged, the state are alleging against them. Paul Murphy and Jason Bonney are both alleged to have provided the gang or its members with access to separate cars on the 5th of February 2016. That's the day David Byrne was shot dead. Patrick Dowdall is accused of making a room available at the Regency Hotel for the criminal organisation or its members on the 4th of February in connection with the murder. Now, the court was told that the men intend to apply for bail. Mr Murphy was remanded in custody last night, and he's expected to make an application this morning. Patrick Dowdall was remanded in custody until Monday. His barrister, Tony McGillicuddy, explained that some work had to be done first before he made his application, and that he had medical issues which needed to be dealt with while he was in custody. However, Jason Bonney applied for bail last night, and his barrister, Carl Monaghan, said that he was a person with no convictions, no bench warrants, and was offering a significant amount of money in the case.
And was there a decision given in that application?
Well, we heard from Detective Sergeant O'Keefe. He said the Gardaí were objecting to bail for Mr Bonney and no bail conditions would satisfy his concerns. He told the court it would be alleged that Jason Bonney was part of a well-organised crime gang involved in the murder of David Byrne. He said it was alleged that Mr Bonney gave logistical support to the persons directly involved in the crime by being part of a convoy and transporting people to and from the scene at a pre-arranged meeting point at St Vincent's Vincent's GAA Club, which is about a mile from the Regency Hotel in North Dublin. Now, the detective also said in evidence there was strong evidence in the case, including CCTV used to track vehicle movements, mobile phone data, and that the vehicle allegedly used by Mr. Bonney to transport the gang was allegedly registered to his business. And he also said the accused's home was quite substantial. He believed he was working as a building contractor and is a person of considerable means. Now, Mr. Bonney himself took the stand and said he could see no reason why the Gardaí would object to him being granted bail. He explained that his wife has worked all her life and she has savings. The court heard he was first arrested as part of this investigation in May of 2016. And when he was asked about Garda concerns of witness interference, Jason Bonney said he would be in no position to intimidate anybody. Quote, with my health, I'm not in a position to mix with anyone. However, the presiding judge, Mr. Justice Tony Hunt, said they would need more information in relation to Mr. Bonney's financial circumstances and for the Gardaí to check the financial proposal from his wife as well as the independent surety. So he was also remanded in custody until next Monday.
Paul Reynolds, thank you very much.
To the virus next, the loss of 11 more people has been reported. The spread of COVID is continuing to slow here. The number of people in hospital is also falling. It's not clear, according to the HSE, if 8 out of 10 adults will be offered a vaccine by the end of June. Our health correspondent Fergal Barris is with us. Fergal, first, we were talking about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine earlier in the programme. Over 40,000 doses were originally due in Ireland this week. What's your understanding of when they'll be used and who'll get them?
Well, Johnson & Johnson says it's ready to resume rolling out its single-dose vaccine after that EMA decision yesterday. But that EMA review was of 8 cases in the US, all in people under 60, mostly women. And it included one death of this rare risk of unusual blood clots with low platelets. Now, so Ireland has a delivery of 600,000 doses of Johnson & Johnson due between now and June. We had been expecting to get over 40,000 doses today, actually, but obviously the pause happened last week. So the company is ready to start delivery, but the HSE can't use them until the National Immunisation Advisory Committee gives its advice and if there's any restrictions in there. So the HSE is going to have to wait to hear the view of NIAC on the EMA recommendations. Those recommendations will be sent to the Chief Medical Officer, who is Dr. Tony Hoolan, who the Department of Health has confirmed has returned to work following a leave in February following the death of his wife. So NIAC's due to meet shortly to consider all of the EMA data, including, I suppose, the information relating to different age groups. And as we heard earlier in the programme, you could see age limits for Johnson & Johnson vaccination. So that would determine who actually is going to get it. And also NIAC's looking at the issue of maybe extending the interval between the Pfizer first and second dose. So quite some significant recommendations due there.
A big drop in the supply of AstraZeneca vaccines this week, Fergal. What would that mean for people in their 60s who are waiting for their job?
Well, there's 417,000 people in the 60 to 69 age group due to get the AstraZeneca vaccination. The second dose is less pressing from a time point of view because there is a 3-month gap and in some cases a 4-month gap. So it's really probably about the first dose, given that there will be more supplies coming in. But once again, the HSE is reporting delays in the supply by AstraZeneca and an expected delivery of 45,000 AstraZeneca doses on Saturday has been cut to 9,000 and a delivery of 165,000 doses of AstraZeneca due at the end of this month is delayed until May 3rd. So the HSE is signalling supply challenges, what it terms. At the Health Committee yesterday, the HSE said it hopes that 800,000 vaccines will be delivered this month. The current target for April to administer vaccines is the target of 860,000 doses, and it's just not clear if that's going to be achieved with 9 days to go.
No, it looks like by the end of this week, according to the latest HSE estimates, that around 550,000 doses will have been done so far this month. So topping 700,000 doses by the end of this month is probably about the best that could be achieved. Would that be fair?
Well, the vaccination targets have changed a lot since the start of the year. And now often, I suppose, they've changed each month and often each week due to supply issues and restrictions on vaccines. It's a very volatile situation. Back in early March, as an early target, the HSC said it was building up to do capacity of 250,000 vaccinations a week. Now, we've not hit that yet, and April is coming to an end. The HSC says it will administer 140,000 to 160,000 doses this week, and also that 170,000 people in that 65 to 69 age group have registered on the portal online or by phone to be vaccinated. So it's encouraged by that. But we're not hitting the levels, I think, that people had hoped to see at this point in time.
When will we find out more about what restrictions will be lifted next, Fergal?
Well, obviously, the NPHET will meet tomorrow and give its advice to government on the various trends. It's always, I think it's fair to say, ultra cautious about easing restrictions. And I don't think you'd envisage any recommended dramatic changes. Anything would be slow and steady changes. All the metrics are, bar problems with vaccination, as we've outlined, are going in the right direction. Hospital cases down, ICU cases steady, daily case numbers, the five-day average dropping. So all of those are good, and they're very important metrics. So the government will look at those and consider the further easing of restrictions. We know that, you know, next Monday, you're going to see the return of golf, tennis, outdoor visitor attractions. And then I think later into next week, people would expect to hear what the government thinking is in relation to June and July.
Fergal, thank you. That's our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
The breakaway European Super League project appears to be on the brink of collapse this morning, with the six English teams announcing that they were pulling out. Organisers of the Super League said they would now look at reshaping the project. This morning, the Liverpool owner, John Henry, has been speaking about the matter.
I want to apologise to all the fan supporters of Liverpool Football Club for the disruption I caused over the past 48 hours. It goes without saying, but should be said, that the project put forward was never going to stand without the support of the fans. No one ever thought differently in England. Over these 48 hours, you were very clear that it would not stand. We heard you. I heard you.
That's John Henry there. We can speak now to our soccer correspondent, Tony O'Donoghue. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Pádraig.
Well, the wheels were fairly quick in falling off the wagon here, weren't they?
It was extraordinary, really. I mean, what a frenzied 48 hours. We had a soap opera, didn't we? It was more dramatic than many games in the group stages of the Champions League, that's for sure. One by one last night, the English clubs gave notice to quit a league that never even had a match in it. Snakes and liars, the UEFA chief, Alexander Schäferin, called those involved in the breakaway group. And he was quick to take them back with open arms. He's delighted to welcome them, he says, back to the football family, that phrase again. No mention at all of sanctions. Is there going to be any punishment for stepping out of line? It's interesting to look at the statements, interesting to hear that apology from John Henry. Arsenal were fairly straight about it. They said, we made a mistake and we apologise for it. Manchester City confirmed they'd formally enacted procedures to withdraw. Tottenham somehow found themselves as a super club. They said they regretted the anxiety and upset caused, but what's important in their statement, they said the club participated in the development of a possible new structure to better ensure financial fair play and financial stability while delivering significantly increased support for the wider football pyramid. And that's pretty key, because football is broken. It's broke. Some of the super clubs have no money. And the pandemic hasn't helped matters in that regard as well. And something needs to be done. UEFA have, you know, re-entered the situation. They are the stakeholders for football. There's that word again. But they've just announced an increase in the Champions League, 100 more matches. They've also added a Europa Conference League to the Europa League from next season. So where is this going? You know, the sanctions, will there be any? Was this all a game of bluff? Because I don't think that the people behind the Super League will meekly go away. They'll meekly apologise for now, but I'm sure this will come back in some shape or form.
And Graeme Souness earlier on was suggesting that this is, that these divisions, these bitter divisions, won't be easily healed. So do you get a sense that this could leave a lot of bad blood?
I think it has, and it's fractured the relationship between fans and their clubs. I think they'll be very loath to believe the corporate speak in the future. It may be beneficial in a sense if it can, you know, create a better bond between the clubs and the fans, but I think that relationship has been fractured. I mean, Florentino Perez, the Real Madrid president, although he's been depicted as a bit crazy, he's made the point that football has to change and adapt. He's wondering why young people between the ages of 16 to 24, 40% not interested in football. There are low-quality games. There's other entertainment platforms now. Something has to change. Football perhaps already has lost the hearts and minds of a generation.
Okay, Tony, thank you very much indeed for that update and analysis. That's our soccer correspondent, Tony O'Donoghue. Danny Mandrow scored a 95th-minute goal for Shamrock Rovers to give them a 1-0 win away to Drogheda United last night. The victory ensures the Hoops remain top of the League of Ireland Premier Division. Also with the same number of points are Sligo Rovers, who beat Bohemians 3-1 at Dalymount Park, and St Patrick's Athletic, who defeated Waterford 1-0 at Richmond Park. Longford Town versus Finn Harps finished 0-0, and there was a 1-1 draw at the Brandywell between Derry City and Dundalk. Derry remain bottom of the table, and in England, Chelsea were held to a scoreless draw at home by Brighton in the Premier League. The draw pushed Chelsea up into fourth place on goal difference above West Ham. Kerry defender Peter Crowley has retired from intercounty football as he approaches his 31st birthday. Crowley has been involved with the panel for the past 10 years. A combination of injury struggles and work commitments have led to his decision. The chairman of the Connacht Council, John Murphy, has clarified the circumstances of Monday's televised draw for the Connacht Football Championship. In an interview in the Irish Examiner, Murphy explained that he had picked one canister out of the bowl before returning it and picking out another one because presenter Marty Morrissey was still explaining the draw and he wanted his selection to coincide with Marty's introduction. In sailing, Ireland is one of 17 countries chasing two qualifying spots for the Olympics at the Laser European Qualification Regatta in Villamoura. Carlo's Finn Lynch is best place. He's in 28th. His cause not helped by a black flag disqualification for early starting in the first race of the day. There was disappointment at the national team trials in Abbottstown for both Brendan Hyland in the 200 metres butterfly and Jack McMillan in the 200 metres freestyle. Both won their semi-finals but were marginally outside the Olympic qualifying standard. They'll now hope to go quicker in the finals tonight. Even though it's not on until next March, more than 25% of the tickets for next year's Cheltenham Festival have already been sold. The course is reporting a major rise in interest with over 70,000 tickets snapped up. It's thought that spectators are very keen to get back racing after not being able to attend this year due to COVID restrictions. And finally, in snooker, Belfast's Mark Allen cruised into the second round of the World Championship with a 10-2 win over China's Liu Haiyichan.
Would teenagers return to the Gaeltacht this summer? The government has issued draft guidelines for the reopening of Irish language summer core schools and plans to talk with colleges and household providers to see if it will be possible to run courses. Our reporter Jonah Sullivan has this report.
I was 12 and I'll never forget how nervous I was.
One of the best experiences that I've ever had.
Would love to go back.
Going to the Gaeltacht over the summer has long been a rite of passage for Irish teenagers, giving them their first taste of independence, a total immersion in the Irish language, and a memorable social experience. But Irish language schools were closed last year due to the pandemic, and a question mark remains over their status this summer. Micheál O'Fuil of Coláiste Lurgan in Galway.
At the beginning of the year, say going back to last Christmas, we were fairly optimistic. So we did take some bookings, all right, but maybe naively so. For level one, I think the recommendation is to have no more than 100 people inside in an enclosed area. So that's where we'd have to be, really, to even for 100 plus students to attend a Cayley or any of the activities that are normal, or the social activities that are normally associated with a course of Gaelic.
When I think of Coláiste Lurgan, I think of that music video that your students did, the Irish version of Wake Me Up by Avicii. And in that video, all the students were crammed into a room. It was the essence of, I guess, your typical Gaeltacht summer school experience.
That's what a course of Gaelic has to be. It's not school. So whatever guidelines that might suit a school, we're in a completely different situation when you're on a course of Gaelic. The social mingling it would be closer a nightclub scenario than it would be a school scenario.
The Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media published draft guidelines for how Irish language schools could reopen this week. Maura Denver of CONCUS, the representative body for Irish language colleges.
Under the draft guidelines, residential courses will not be allowed to operate at level 3, 4 and 5. Further talks are required with the department as regards the feasibility of the reopening or whether it would be possible to operate under the guidelines, even in level 1 and 2. And the department is meeting with the Banatees and with CONCUS, the umbrella organisation, as I mentioned earlier, later in the week or early next week. And hopefully by next week, we will be very clear, and much more clear, on the situation.
Under the draft guidelines, no students would be permitted to stay in the traditional Banontee households under levels 3, 4 or 5. Under levels 1 or 2, students from three different households would be permitted. Mally E. Clarty is a Banontee in Connemara.
I would have mixed feelings in that I would love to be able to have the students. I would love that sense of normality to be there. But to be honest, there's a part of me that's still very worried. My house would take 7 and they could be from 4 or 5 different counties. So the thought of, after a year of separating ourselves from even relatives that live in the other counties, the thought of bringing strangers into your house to mix together and to mix with your family just seems so alien to us right now. So I can't imagine how that can be done safely.
Can I ask you, what kind of a difference does it make to the area when the students arrive?
Oh, it makes a huge difference. The local economy depends on it. It's not just the Marathi, like myself, but it's the shops, the local shops, the takeaways, the bus drivers that bring all the students up to different colleges. It's the kayaking services. It's, you know, all along the line, there's a huge ripple effect, really.
The sector is worth an estimated €50 million to the Gaeltacht areas in Galway, Donegal, Mayo and Kerry. But the Irish Second Level Students' Union say the experience for the almost 30,000 teenagers that attend annually is what's really priceless. Katie Halpenhill.
Public health has to come first and student safety is absolutely imperative. Like, it has to come first before anything else. It would be a real shame if the Irish colleges couldn't reopen. Even socially, those students who maybe have never been away from home and were looking forward to going to the Gaeltacht to spend 3 weeks away from home, you know, meeting other students from across the country and making friends and stuff. You know, that's all something that I suppose the pandemic has kind of taken away from students. And those benefits, you can't be understated. You know, it would be a real shame, I suppose, if we weren't in a position to open the Irish colleges again this year.
Katie Halpenhill of the Irish Second Level Students Union there, ending that report by Joan O'Sullivan. In a statement last night, the department told us that the conditions necessary for the reopening of Irish language summer schools are likely to be more favourable by August, and that they'll try to make a decision as early as possible after the consultation process ends next Tuesday. If you want to get involved, email to caloistagaelge@tcagsm.gov.ie by Tuesday next.
Shortly after the Derek Chauvin verdict last night, Professor of African American Studies at the University of Berkeley, California, Nikki Jones, gave her reaction to our reporter Angus Cox.
As I listened to the verdict, it was what I expected. And at the same time, I had an understanding that just because I expected it didn't necessarily mean that it would be delivered. The history of prosecuting police officers for violence against Black people makes anyone hesitant to have any kind of confidence in a guilty verdict. And at the same time, it was clear that the argument in this court, in this case, only pointed one toward a guilty verdict. You know, so it is in some ways a relief to see that that was in fact the verdict that was delivered, because I think it was the right verdict. And at time, it's not a relief in the sense that it solves any of the major problems that have brought people out into the streets a year ago and has added momentum to this movement against police violence and systemic racism. And so I also fear that if people see it as a victory and an endpoint, that it will actually limit the possibility for transformation that remains necessary even after the reading of this verdict.
So how should this verdict best be used when it comes to race relations, or what is the positive that can come out of this now, do you think?
When I think about policing, I think about the extraordinary violence of policing and the ordinary dominance of policing. And this certainly was a rebuke of the extraordinary violence of policing. And at the same time, in setting Derek Chauvin's actions and behaviors as extraordinary, and indeed they were extraordinary, but that's what it takes for an entire institution to come down against violence against Black people as it is delivered through policing, then that leaves a lot of ordinary dominance, ordinary aggression, routine violence that can be more legitimized in the wake of this trial. And so that's a real concern of mine, that in setting Derek Chauvin as an outlier, everything that does not cross that line, the things that go up to that line but don't cross it, are somehow seen as legitimate or justified because they don't violate policy in as obvious a way. And in fact, I think that is the root of the problem of policing. And these acts of extraordinary violence are just the tip of the iceberg.
And that was Nikki Jones from the University of Berkeley, California. Let's talk finally to Dr. Eboon Joseph, Director of the Institute of Anti-Racism and Black Studies at UCD. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you share that worry that Nikki Jones voiced there, that people might see this verdict not as the beginning now of something, but that as an end, see it as an end point?
I share that. Well, I don't think so, because I'm worried that shouldn't be the case, because as it is now, you know, think about it. It took 10 hours of deliberation, 10 hours. We all saw that. What did we need 10 hours to do that for? That is number one. Then the second thing we have to look at is that, you know, that all of this happened in a public space, you know. And so my own worry is that, you know, people should not, that we should not, because this has not ended, do you understand? Like, we still have this continuing. We still have the killing. You know, we had Barack Obama when he became president. We thought, oh, this is, you know, we're post-race. It didn't happen. You know, look at everything that happened after all of that. So with this verdict right now, this is not it. We have to keep on. The pressure must still be on. We must look for things, you know, around, you know, just the sentencing, you know, policing, the stereotyping of Black bodies, you know, Black boys, Black bodies, you know, the constant killing, that must continue. This is just one case. And look at how long it took. There's a worldwide outcry. And that's why this case ended this way. I'm not surprised. This is exactly what I expected. But think about it, that we were all waiting. We were all not, there was none of us who was 100% sure. The fact that we were not 100% sure means that there is something fundamentally wrong with the system, and we cannot stop at that.
So what changes from today, if there is to be change, for Black officers, for police officers on patrol in the United States, and what changes for the young Black men and women that they pull over?
The young Black men are already doing what they've asked them to do. Yes, sir. No, ma'am. Put your hands up. My hands are here. They are already doing more than enough. They've learned how to force down their fears and not say anything. They are doing enough. But what we need now is, you know, we said that, you know, there are only a few bad apples within the police. Now the question we are asking is, where are the good apples? We are not seeing the good apples. We know there are good apples within the police. Where are the good apples? We need the good apples to begin to speak up within the system itself. They need to begin to speak up. The fact that they are not speaking up begins to show you how much power that system holds and how much fear is within the system. So there have to be massive policy changes. The policies are in place that racism and all of this only happens because of two things. One, the policies and the law. That is the place the change must happen, the policies and the law. But fair play to everybody. The one thing that as citizens we can keep on doing, we must continue citizen journalism. That is the only reason this case has ended this way. Bring okay. out your phone, record things if you can.
Dr. Eboon Joseph from UCD, thank you very much.